This is the Beat Your Genes podcast. My name is Nate G. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Ha, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during a show and ask a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751. Or you can send us a question through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk. How are you both doing this evening?
Good.
Well, how are you?
I'm doing fantastic. So it's the start of the new year, and last week we talked a little bit about the pleasure trap, about losing weight without losing your mind. Had a really cool explanation from Dr. Hawk about process-oriented goals and how to reframe New Year's resolutions to maximize your success. And Dr. Lyle, we had some really awesome commentary about your previous video called Losing Weight Without Losing Your Mind as well. Today, we've got a few questions kind of in the same topic, but I was looking at, I was reading an article, and it got me interested only because it had the word Harvard researchers on there.
Should be a dangerous flag.
Yeah.
and so the name of the article is called Harvard Researchers Help Explain the Link Between Emotion and Addictive Substance Use.
Oh. Good now, for them.
Now, though, based on what I've learned from you both here on the podcast, I wanted to read more just to see exactly what they were saying. And so I won't read a long whole thing about the studies. There were four integrated studies, but they essentially were trying to figure out what drives a person to smoke cigarettes and what keeps them, what gets them to relapse when they have quit for a while. And so the study was basically data from a national survey of more than 10,000 people over 20 years and the laboratory test examining the responses of current smokers to negative emotions. And one study tested the volume and the frequency of the actual puffs on cigarettes by smokers who were volunteered to be monitored. A couple of other studies, I lost my place here. So what they found was, the conclusion was, that when people are sad, when they are feeling sadness, then they get more triggered, to relapse or to use the addictive substance. So, you know, they had some public policy implications. For example, they thought maybe current anti-smoking ad campaigns could be redesigned to avoid images that trigger sadness and thus unintentionally increasing cigarette cravings among smokers. My first thought is thinking, well, if the cigarette companies found out about this study and if it were in fact true, maybe they would start making ads that trigger sadness in people.
Good totally. Thinking, Nathan.
So, that's definitely what the alcohol advertisers do.
Yeah. So
you're lonely at home, get a six pack of beer and everything's happier.
Yeah. Yeah, because I remember when Coca-Cola was like, you know, open happiness. That was their big campaign.
Open happiness. McDonald's also, you know, like, has a lot of happiness-related slogans.
Right. Yeah. And so it reminded me when I read The Pleasure Trap, Dr. Lyle, the book that you wrote, the most fascinating part for me, the first part that I remember just getting really excited about, besides learning about how a gray shrike pokes bugs and put them on thorns, the really cool part was distinguishing between pleasure and happiness, and how it seemed that many people will mistake those two emotions or those two feelings, and how if they're deficient in one, they might, if they're not happy, they might try to compensate for that for seeking for pleasure. So, Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, can we get your take on this?
Well, I looked at this, I didn't read the whole article, but I just read some of the comments by the researchers, and I did I saw that thing about them being worried about their ads, that they might trigger sadness, or they might trigger, if they look too negative about smoking, that might trigger sadness, and then that would impact people to smoke more. This is like delusions of grandeur. I mean, these people, they got to Harvard, and then they think that every thought that they have is golden. I don't know what they're thinking.
It's a common problem.
Yeah.
I could tell you some stories from some seminars.
This is absurd. To believe that you could push human behavior around so easily is, of course, ludicrous. The research that they've done is just even the sound of it is just silly, and I'm sure has almost no merit whatsoever. If we're going to try to understand why people relapse, people would love to blame the fact that they were sad on whether or not they relapsed. However, the truth of the matter is that the most common reasons for relapse are channel factors, and also the actual stimuli itself, and also straight Pavlovian spontaneous recoveries. So I note that they don't appear to have controlled
for anything.
Okay, they actually went out after this study with an idea in mind. Okay,
yeah.
And then used their survey data to retrospectively ask people, you know, gee, when you relapsed, were you kind of sad before you relapsed? I mean, this is absurd.
Yeah.
So yeah, go ahead, Jen.
Well, it's very similar to people who blame sort of disease processes on emotional, like we talked about last week. So there's some
right.
emotional cause of some kind of pathology. And those are all retrospective as well. And it's the same kind of question, like, oh, so I see that you have cancer, you know, were you experiencing some anger, some unexpressed anger in the last year? And people say, well, by golly, I sure was. I had a lot of rage at my father that I never expressed. And the new age people will come right in and say, oh, well, you've held that in your lungs, and that's why you have lung cancer. You have a great deal of unexpressed sadness. So this is just about as valid to do it with this kind of result in mind as well.
Yeah, the truth is we can see, for example, we had a beautiful experiment here in the last 30 or 40 years to see what would actually help people stop smoking. And mm-hmm. it's not going to be the ads orchestrated by these geniuses from Harvard or the American government, who I'm sure that because they went to a fancy school, that they'll get nice, solid jobs there working for, you know, the United States Council on Health or whatever it is. And
you're enjoying the Harvard smack talk a little too much on this episode, I gotta say. You pushed it a little too far.
Dr. Hawk, tell us where you went to school again.
She went to the University of Washington.
Yeah, University of Washington. Wow. Honors. Yeah.
But the point here is that we already know, and we know that channel factors, by channel factors, what we mean is the ease of access, and this is because there isn't anything really mysterious going on in addiction or relapse. All that's happening is cost-benefit analysis. That's what's happening with all behavior, and so I can see why. Actually, it just occurred to me that I could see why some people, when you've heard this for the 80th time, if you don't understand deeply that all a brain is a cost-benefit analyzing computer for gene survival chips. So that's, or gene survival probabilities. That's what a brain is. That's what it evolved to do. If you didn't know this and you just heard cost-benefit analysis a few times, you would start to think that this is a sort of tautology, it's just a story, that everything, you can always go back and say, well, why did the person do it? Well, it's because the benefit outweighed the cost. That's why they did what they did. But it's true.
That's true.
And so there would be no other reason for one neural circuit to be activated and another neural circuit to be deactivated, and to have one chosen over the other in terms of an option. And so, so when we're going to start to look at something like relapse, we're just, we begin the question with cost benefit analysis. Now, these people are assuming all kinds of things in their dreamlike study. And that is that negative emotion drives the use of substances. You've got to be kidding me. Has anybody visited a bar, you know, on Super Bowl Sunday? Yeah, let's just go in there. We're all depressed because our team's in the Super Bowl, and that's why we're ordering up the beer, because we're really depressed.
Or let's control for who drinks more, the people rooting for the winning team or the losing team. Do we really think there's going to be a statistically significant difference there?
That's actually a great study if someone wanted to test their own hypotheses. So the if it's such a, quote, depressant, why is it that, that everybody's using it in celebrations, for God's sakes?
Right.
Okay. So, no, the whole notion that, that this is the wise, you know, sort of the wise nodding therapist, oh, well, the reason why you relapse was because, you know, you had some, you've had some sadness. You've got to be kidding me. No. So the relapses take place under all kinds of differing conditions, and sadness driving a relapse and therefore a desire to, you know, shift your emotional state out of sadness, maybe, okay, but probably no more likely than being in a celebratory mood and wanting to extend it with whatever it is. Most important would be just channel factors. So some, your New Year's party and some, you know, attractive woman, if you're a guy, offers you a cigarette, you've been sober on the cigarettes for a year, but maybe it's time to break it because you wouldn't want to, you know, you wouldn't want to turn her down. So all kinds of reasons, including very important Pavlovian reasons being spontaneous recovery. But notice spontaneous recovery is just no reason at all. The nervous system, the deep reasoning of the nervous system is if there's been a resource that's been important, i.e. anything that's stoked the dopamine pathway in an accentuated fashion, which cigarettes would, then even if you get away from it and you get into extinction and therefore you are off the sauce there, that doesn't mean that every now and then there won't be a lighting up of the scoreboard inside your head to basically cause you to go back and see if that resource still exists. These are behavioral programs. They're instincts inside of animal brains that are designed by nature for animals to go back to the scene of where they were very well fed and see if they can recover that resource. Well, your brain doesn't really know the difference too well between the dopamine flood of a cigarette and the flood of getting fed. In other words, they're both rewarding. They're both telling the organism that there's been an evolutionary win. And so even if you get away from drugs or alcohol or something that has addicted you, the brain will spontaneously cause a motivational rush from time to time that will cause you to go back and seek that stimuli. That's super important to understand.
Yeah, particularly if there's an associated cue in the environment.
Yes.
Too. There's a particular smell or you're in mm-hmm. the same kind of place or you're in, you know, you see somebody or you're reminded of somebody. So all of those things mm-hmm. can contribute. So those might be associated with sadness because you were sad when you were an addict. So there may be feelings of sadness that co-arise with those cues that are generating the recovery, but that's not what's actually driving the process.
Yeah, this is a paper mache explanation of relapse, and it doesn't tell us anything about what would be effective with anything we already know. And that is when they banned smoking from buildings, the smoking dropped dramatically in the United States. So it went from 40 something percent down to below 20 in, you know, a generation. And the reasons for this are just pure hassle. And so this is so the CB is clearly impacting, you know, this more than anything else is just the energy conservation processes. So so thinking that one's ad, you know, some trivial little effect of some transient emotional state that is driving real is just ludicrous. So, oh well.
Thank you. Yeah, so the third study, they were trying to figure out, you know, they measured impatience for, mm-hmm. for cigarette puffs, and they said that the result was built upon previous research findings that sadness increases financial impatience. And so that reminded me of one of your DVDs called The Willpower Paradox, where mm-hmm. You cite the work of Roy Baumeister mm-hmm. Saying essentially that if you have low blood sugar, if you're hungry, you're vastly more likely to make more impulsive decisions. And so I couldn't help but wonder if sadness may have a similar effect in terms of making more impulsive decisions or being, you know, unable to control this type of, you know, to control it.
I just want to back up for a second and talk about sadness. So these people act like it's some kind of unfortunate disease process that's creating mischief. It's not. This is a incredibly delicately orchestrated mechanism shaped by evolution in order to tell the organism what to do. That's what it is. Okay, it's not destructive. Sadness isn't the slightest bit destructive. Neither is the excruciating pain that you get in your ankle when you've sprained it. That's not destructive. Okay, so we don't want to rush in there and block the pain with a medication. That would be a disaster. The pain is a signaling device. The pain isn't damaging. This is also the absurdity of the new age crap about, you have all these pent-up emotions and they're causing you physiological damage. Under what evolutionary cockamamie transmogrification of causality could you ever come up with such an idea? Why would an organism ever orchestrate its own self-destruction?
Chakras are the mechanism. It all gets stuck in there, starts turning the wrong direction.
It's ludicrous, okay? So the sadness is not going to orchestrate self-destructive behavior at all. It's designed by nature to shape effective behavior. That's why when you get sad after you've just lost, you know, your last $200 in a slot machine in Vegas, you know, that sadness is to tell you...
Yeah.
Hey, chief, you know, this wasn't,
bad
this
move.
Really isn't your town.
Yeah.
Okay. The sadness is to tell you when the girl told you the fourth time, no, we're not going out anymore. Yeah, you're sad, but it's a signaling device to tell you that the game is lost and therefore you need to back up and re-engineer your thinking about how you're going to expend your resources because this one's a lost cause. That's what sadness is. So the notion that sadness would engineer drug relapse, maybe. I'm sure there are times when that's true, that for some reason someone takes that option. But most of the time, no, that wouldn't be the case. The relapse is going to be vastly more to do with channel factors than it's going to be with anything else. And sadness per se is no disease process that we want to inherently avoid. It's an experience that's trying to, that you can't avoid because you're going to have some failures and you're going to have some losses in life. And sadness is a mechanism to signal to you that something of value is lost. That's what it is. So instead of feeling like it's a plague that visits some people that have tried to quit smoking and then it causes them to relapse it, why don't we understand that sadness per se, these people are attempting to live their lives as intelligently as possible and as effectively as possible, and then sometimes they lose, as we all do. And so when they lose, the sadness that they feel is an inherent mechanism that's designed by nature to signal them, to teach them about that they lost and get them to examine why. The notion that, oh God, that's a terrible thing, that sadness thing. We can't better not have an ad with sad music on it when we're talking about cigarettes because somehow that's going to visit them like, you know, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, and now it's going to cause this relapse. I mean, that is just insane.
Out of control process.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, the notion that these feelings that you have are somehow as if they are visiting from somewhere else or that there's some independent process, independent of your life process, independent of your hunger, independent of your sleepiness, independent of being warm or cold, independent of being, thirsty, independent of feeling, you know, in physical pain or not. No, they're all part of the same process, which are signaling mechanisms to help you adjust your behavior in ways that optimize your survival and reproductive success. They're not some inherently destructive process, even when they're negative. Okay, so this is actually a fundamental misunderstanding of many people, blatantly in the New Age world.
And the Buddhist world, that you have the monkey mind that's just spontaneously generating thoughts that don't have anything to do with anything. They're just like floating across your mind like clouds. So you have to detach from them and then you can freely rewrite them. So if they're making you sad or they're making you unhappy or you feel shame because of those thoughts, they're just random thoughts that the monkey mind is generating. So you can just think different thoughts. You just don't have to attach to the bad thoughts. You attach to the good thoughts. And this is how it works in this world. And a lot of contemporary therapy just adopts these ideas as if they're true.
Yeah, that's what 30 years ago got me, you know, parting ways with much of the thinking in cognitive therapy, i.e. when therapists will say, well, which thought is working for you?
Oh, yeah.
Which thought would be more beneficial?
Yeah, they love to ask that question.
It's amazing. It's the quote, monkey mind isn't some self-destructive, haywire, bizarre feature of you that you can somehow control. These are deep logical algorithms that exist inside your brain that are giving rise to concerns that you're having.
Right.
And if you look at what those concerns are, they're not random. You're not concerned that the next door neighbor's cat is about to drop out of the tree and land on its head. No, that isn't what comes to mind.
Well, now I am.
What?
now that you've brought it up.
Right. So your mind is scanning the evidence that your senses give you, and it's relating that evidence that it's giving you to data that's already in the data banks, and you're analyzing probabilities, and you are coming up with a SWOT analysis, a strength, weaknesses, opportunity, and threat analysis about where you stand relative to your environmental opportunities and threats. And the thoughts that you have are running down, attempting to estimate parameters around those threats. So the notion that somehow the solution to stopping people from relapsing smoking is to block them from, I can just see the next move. Oh, what we need is to give them antidepressants.
Yeah, of course.
You know,
because this random terrible process has befallen them and we need to medicate it. That's the natural solution.
There you go. That's like, I can almost smell a tobacco company grant that was associated with this thing. So I don't know if that's true, of course, not tobacco, pharmaceutical company, which turns out they're the same people. This is all very weak thinking, but well, what the heck? On we go.
Yeah. One thing that it seemed to me like a little limitation of the study is if people are more sad, and they therefore supposedly triggered their addictive substance use. Mm-hmm. Where does emotional instability come into play? So if the people who feel this more often, they're going to be the ones more often to medicate and celebrate.
This is one of the many things they didn't control for.
That's beautiful, Nathan. That's really good thinking.
But of course, there's no personality anywhere in any of these four studies they talk about, because it didn't even occur to them to control for personality, because nobody's even thinking about personality, much less controlling for it.
Now, it sounds like they did control for other negative emotions, and so they specifically teased out sadness.
How are they defining sadness? How are they distinguishing sadness from shame? Like, why are people being triggered by sadness but not shame? That's the first question that came to me when I read the abstract. Like, how the heck are you distinguishing between those two things in the process? Like, and the it's experimentally induced sadness, so they're showing people pictures of lonely kittens in the rain or whatever it is to make them feel sadness. It's not sadness that's actually associated with any of their competitive processes. So what's the thinking that if you see a sad picture, then you're tapping into your internal sad processes? Like, I there's none of it makes any sense to me.
Yeah.
But it's all premised on the idea that your behavior and your circumstances are a result of your your emotions and your thoughts, and it's absolutely has the causality reverse. Your emotions are symptoms. Your emotions and your thoughts are symptoms of your circumstances and your behavior. They're not driving those things.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
So rather than trying to avoid sadness, we want to get back to the fundamentals, which is what you've both talked about, is just set up your environment so that you're less likely to experience difficulty in life situations in general, and therefore less difficulty in sticking to the plan. Or
what, let me talk about this. First of all, you can't do that because you're doing that anyway as best you can. But when it comes to addiction, the most important thing you do is you look out for the channel factors that can get you.
What is a channel factor?
Channel factors are going to be, you better not hang out with friends that smoke, okay? You avoid the places where you used to go where you know that there's cigarettes handy. These are, and you do that from a long ways away. And so you, this is the types of things that you can do. So you avoid, the parties and the people that were associated with a lot of smoking and where it was all cool and everybody was patting each other on the back, and it was part of the subculture. So these are the best things that you can do, and you can also sometimes do some things that highlight and underscore for yourself the wins associated with being smoke free, which would be like, for example, I don't know, getting up in the morning and running for 20 minutes. So just knowing what it feels like to have your lungs clear and enjoying that process and making that a regular practice. So these are the types of things that you want to do. I could tell 1,000 stories of relapse that I've worked with addicts over the years in all different kinds of substances. But one of my quote favorite stories, it's not a favorite, it's an instructive one, was a superbly intelligent and superbly disciplined client, very unusually so. So extremely intelligent, extremely self-disciplined. And that person had an alcohol problem and was clean for a long time and had engineered his life around everything that he could to see to it that he wouldn't come anywhere near where the alcohol problems had arisen. And then, and that included where he got off on the freeway on his way home. And then one day they were working on that freeway off ramp, and it caused him to not be able to use that off ramp. He had to go to the next off ramp, and that extra off ramp took him past the liquor store that he had been to many times to buy a specific drink, and he got it. He relapsed. Okay, so that's a channel factor. And so that's recognizing and understanding that you're an animal that's running CBs. And if you do your level best to try to keep the CBs loaded in favor of your success, then you have a much better chance. Trust me, I've had many people say, well, I heard you say that, Dr. Lyle, but I can get in the car and drive 17 miles to, get myself a chocolate parfait at my favorite
less
place.
Less likely to do it. It's more difficult to do it, and that might be just difficult enough.
Yeah.
Like you don't know how difficult it has to be to make it out of reach for your CB. So
right.
It may not be as dramatic as you're thinking it has to be. It might just be slightly uncomfortable. You're just not willing to take that extra step. The day I got sober, I tried to quit alcohol several times before I successfully was able to. Mm-hmm. And the day that I actually turned out to be day one of permanent sobriety, it was just because I happened to have gotten through all of my alcohol the night before and I didn't have any left over for the next day. So that had not been the pattern. The pattern was I always had enough to sort of get started the next afternoon and then you go get more, and it's just the cycle repeats itself. So that day I just happened to not have any, and it would have been I was hungover and it would have been a pain to go out and get more, and the store wasn't that far away, but it was like snowy outside, and it was like, I'll just go one day and I won't do it. And that was all it took. So that started that turned that whole ship around. So you never know how big a channel factor you're dealing with any particular nervous system, and people can really overestimate how pure they need to make the environment or how strict they need to be with themselves sometimes.
This is fantastic. Let me tell people, I don't know that I've told this story or this concept before, but it just, your story just gave rise to this, Jen. And so it's a time to talk about this. this is, if we go back in time to the 1920s, the 1930s, there was a European social psychologist named Kurt Lewin, or Levine in his primary tongue. And he was a major theorist. In fact, he is the father of modern social psychology. So he is the man that began the concept of running experiments. And so you all know Alan Funt from Candid Camera. Well, the Alan Funt got his master's degree under Kurt Levine in New York. And so that Candid Camera is a set of social psychological experiments. Mm-hmm. That's what it is.
Entertaining ones.
Yes, entertaining ones. And so Lewin's idea was that instead of just doing naturalistic observation of people, if you thought about what variables you were interested in, you could enhance them and essentially put them put force behind them, and then see what the reactionary force it was inside people. So that is what social psychology is. The grandest, you know, his quote intellectual children were people like Stanley Milgram of the famous Milgram studies, and other people, Solomon Asch and people of that nature, that did these experiments where they put people in tough situations that called for them to make decisions, and they didn't, you know, they weren't sure what the right thing was to do. So Darley and Latané did famous experiments with bystander interventions or with emergencies. So if you have somebody sitting in a waiting room and you have somebody walk by, or you have another person sitting in the waiting room with them, and you have a guy walk by into another room, into a back room, and then he's got a ladder with him, and then you hear the ladder fall and crash, and you hear the guy yelling, you know, if your person in the waiting room with you doesn't make a move, the odds that I will make a move are about 10%. But if there isn't another person in the waiting room with me, the odds that I'm going to go back and check it out are like 90%. So these are fascinating little studies that are uncovering what Lewin called the field. And what the field was in Lewin's mind was a set of forces that was pushing against each other in what we would now recognize as a cost-benefit analysis. It was perfectly, perfectly well-conceived by Lewin, because it's exactly the way I think of it. I now think of Lewin's field as a set of qualities and inequalities with mathematical coefficients about gene survival. And so essentially Lewin's field is all of these different forces are pushing. Now, one of Lewin's beautiful contributions was the notion that a very tiny factor in this field, think of this field as an interwoven set of causality that, you know, goes back to, I don't know, we've got a literary person with us. Who told the famous story of, you know, my kingdom for a horse, or for the want of a nail, the kingdom was lost?
Oh, God, I don't know. I fail that pop quiz. It's a good thing we're not at pub trivia, because I'm not sure.
Shakespeare's Richard III or something?
Sounds like Shakespeare.
Oh, good for you, Nathan. just pull something out that sounds smart.
I just Googled it. No, I Googled it.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
I think it is.
What do you know?
This expression comes from the play Richard III by the English playwright William Shakespeare.
That's Nathan's disagreeable swagger. That's willing just to Google it very stealthily and then just come out with the answer.
That's so good. All right. So yeah, this is this notion that a small, tiny factor could have cataclysmic impact. And so the social psychologists Richard Nisbet and Lee Ross at Stanford. Nisbet at Michigan actually analyzed, you know, went back and thought about many things in history that you could think about history in terms of these Lewinian force fields. And one of the things that they thought about, for example, was the downfall of the Soviet Union, and that where the notion was is that that something that appears very, very static, like there's no way it could change, may in fact be not moving because there are tremendous forces pushing against each other. And in fact, if there's a tiny little change of the force, then the entire system can become tremendously disrupted. And so think of your two hands pushing against each other. They could be pushing against you very lightly, or they could be pushing each other with tremendous force. And if you couldn't see the muscles switching, if you were just looking at the hands, you wouldn't know whether or not there was tremendous force against that or whether the forces were light. And the same thing is true when you're talking, maybe you've got some new romantic relationship and it seems a little uncomfortable about something. You can't tell whether there are tremendous forces pushing that person or whether it's just a little bit of a light thing. You're not sure. Okay? Now, in the case of the story Jen tells about herself, there it turns out that what we discovered was that there was a tremendous force pushing against the drinking.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely. I mean, that was like the fourth or fifth serious attempt.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So there was huge forces against it. There was huge forces for it. In other words, the addiction process itself. And the difference between winning and losing was a tiny channel factor. Okay. So this is Richard III. And so this is... So these folks here in this whole study are kind of looking in the wrong place. They're trying mysteriously, they're ignoring the fact that, obviously, as Nathan pointed out, that the more unstable people are having more negative emotional responses. But they're running around trying to say, oh my God, negative emotional responses. Well, that's probably, you know, going to cause some relapse, right? Don't bad feelings cause relapse? It's like, well, I don't know, maybe a little bit, but it's not the main factor. The main factor is going to be these important channel factor issues, and those things are going to be more, obviously, were massively more successfully done by legislation that stopped people from smoking in buildings. Now, I don't know that you have anything similar today that you could do. They've taxed the daylights out of cigarettes. You can make them more expensive. At some point, people will start smuggling them.
I wonder... know that I've played poker in a casino before, and I see signs where you can actually, if someone's a problem gambler, they can go to the casino and ask to be put on a list where they are now no longer allowed to step foot inside the casino, and otherwise they'll be arrested for trespassing.
Yes.
So I wonder if future legislation may include where you're not actually, you opt out of, you know, the 7-Eleven or whatever store selling cigarettes,
and they won't let you do it. I've told clients to do that when they live like really close to a store where they go and they're in a cram circuit or they're getting junky food. So this of course could work for any addictive substance where you just go to the manager and say, hey, here's a photo of me, put a photo of me in your back office and don't let me in here. If you see me, please ask me to leave. So you're just raising the social cost and trying to create a little bit of a channel factor, and whether they act on it or not, the fact that you know that you've done that is going to help keep you out of that.
Yeah,
place.
I guess if the manager doesn't comply, then you can always just make a scene and so that you actually are banned from there.
That's
doesn't affect
CV.
Your life that much if it's that bad.
Definitely.
Nathan's creative twist.
But this is why people will place bets, you know, where they have to. There's some sort of big punishment associated with losing the bet where you have to make a donation to the opposing political party, or there's something like, or a public declaration of your support for someone that you hate, or things like this. This is trying to manufacture some kind of public shaming process that creates a channel factor that, because people are aware if they raise the costs of this behavior, then they're less likely to engage in it.
Yeah, I just had that happen with a friend of mine where I was trying to break a cycle of potato chips for myself. and it's a guy that I compete against, but it's friendly competition, but like we're really hard competitors.
Yeah.
And so I told him, I said, well, okay, so I'm going to go without, you know, the potato chips for a week. Mm-hmm. And if I do, then if I don't, if I relapse, then I have to give you, you know, a few $100. And of course, I relapsed. I gave him the money, and I told him, "said Yeah, I just don't hate you enough."
Yeah.
So he took me out to lunch a few times with my own money.
Oh, that's excellent.
Oh my goodness.
Whatever works.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
All right. Maybe
all right.
Just
our next
one more question.
Yeah. Our first question.
Yeah.
Is...
There you go.
Now that we've actually gotten out of the chit chat.
Yeah.
Oh, it's great. It was great. I think, it explained a lot in my mind, because I think, the researchers, of course, we're going to go back a little bit, but the researchers in this particular case, they were quoted as saying that our work suggests that the reality is much more nuanced than the idea of feel bad, smoke more. But, what you guys are saying makes a lot more sense in the context of the practical application of this.
Yeah, so. A nuanced explanation of feel bad, smoke more doesn't realize that feel bad, smoke more is the wrong premise to begin with. So nuancing doesn't get you anywhere. Although it gets you published, yeah. I suppose.
No, I appreciate that. That's correcting a distortion of mine. Okay. All right. So our question is, dear Dr. Lyle, dear Dr. Hawk, most of the people I know use chemicals to manage their lives, as at least in some aspects, coffee to wake up, alcohol for social lubrication, SSRIs when they're feeling down, Xanax and beta blockers for anxiety, Adderall or cocaine sometimes for productivity and charisma, and so on and so forth. And even knowing what I know, it's hard to resist the feeling that I'm leaving some competitive advantage on the table by not partaking in all those things. I assume that you both would discourage the use of most, if not all, of these substances. But is it because you think they are all net negative in the long run, or do you find that the whole concept puts the cart before the horse by trying to mold emotions to fit the environment instead of working on the environment? And if are there any exceptions?
Yeah, well, this is really a continuation of the whole conversation. So this is we can hashtag ask the alcoholic here. So this is like actually getting the essence of the question right, though, where instead of talking about, oh, well, what sort of emotional processes is pushing me to indulge in some substance, it's like, oh, indulging in the substance gets me, there's a cost benefit associated with some payoff related to using this thing. So I actually just posted on Facebook the other day, this article that got a lot of conversation going that was written by an evolutionary psychologist at Oxford named Robin Dunbar about alcohol and how alcohol is sort of the secret of civilization. That it's, there's this real competitive advantage to drinking and to social drinking because you have this sort of collective endorphin effect where everybody's your best friend and it smooths over conflicts of interest. And obviously it's a mating aid and it's helpful in a lot of human social processes, lowers inhibitions, all of these things. So these are all very good reasons to indulge in alcohol, and they can even be it is a competitive advantage in a lot of ways to use a particular substance. It's obviously a competitive advantage to use caffeine. I continue to be an unrepentant caffeine addict, and I run that CB all the time where I drink my coffee, and I know that there's a cost to it, but there's also a benefit to it. So this is obviously, there's huge costs associated with alcohol use, regardless of what sort of social benefit there may be or how that may be linked to our ancestral history or whatever Professor Dunbar is observing. You have to be aware of those consequences and run that CB accordingly, because you're not going to get an effect from anything without a side effect. That's the whole point of any drug use. There's always a side effect if you're getting any kind of effect at all. And you may not be entirely aware of what that side effect is or how long-term it's going to be or how much damage it's going to do to you. The caffeine, the sort of consequences of caffeine are much more, there's sort of a delayed response to some of those consequences, because essentially what it's doing is it's robbing my sleep quality over time. And so I'm not getting as much quality sleep as I might otherwise be getting. And there's some evidence to suggest that might be putting me at risk for, certain types of mental degeneration later in life. So when I run that CB, it's like, well, a cup of coffee sounds really good this morning. It's going to make me a little more awake. It's going to give me a little more attention for some writing I want to do or whatever it is I want to focus on. And, any kind of consequence for that is really far out in the distance, and I'm not going to worry about it too much. Whereas obviously with something like alcohol, you've got a different trade, and different individual nervous systems have entirely different CBs on particular substance use. So I think in general, yes, you are with all of this. This is trying to engineer the self to fit the environment. The questioner has that right. And so in general, we're going to advise against all of this kind of stuff, but that doesn't mean that there is potentially specific benefits associated with particular substance use. But you just have to be very clear-eyed and open to what those consequences look like and whether it's worth it for you.
And coffee probably is a lot less addictive than, say, cocaine. So coffee, right, for a particular project that needs to be, sure, done may be more in line with, you know, potential benefit.
And that's a really good point, that obviously some, you know, these things are working on the pleasure pathways a little differently. So you don't want to play with too much fire with some of this brain hacking that people are doing, where if they're going to hack your productivity with cocaine, yeah, that's probably not going to be advisable under any circumstances. Or microdosing LSD, which is like all in vogue right now. Like, this is not something that people should be doing. This is that you're really playing with fire, not because you're going to develop an addictive response to LSD, because you know so little about what those consequences are going to be, what the long-term process looks like, what kind of damage you're potentially doing. Like, there are different degrees of worthwhile experimentation with these substances here. So caffeine, social drinking is one thing, cocaine, LSD, heroin, that's another thing. So, but you know, people are sovereign unto their own cost-benefit analysis. So go forth and run your CB.
I remember when I read Malcolm Gladwell, one of his books, and I believe it's in the acknowledgement section where he acknowledges, you know, the people that helped him. And he also thanks, is grateful for Provigil, which is the, you know, wakefulness, mm-hmm, drug.
Right. That's also very in vogue. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Yeah. But that's basically what I don't know if Doug has other things to add to that.
No, I guess I would just summarize the following in general, and that is that it's very difficult to beat the experience of nature impacting your DNA the way it's supposed to. And so you are exquisitely designed through 3,500 million years of evolution. And you weren't designed to be having any substance that distorts the nervous system. And so when we obviously, as we're all talking, we're all like reasonable, we're not crazy, we're not prudes, any of us. But messing with that equipment, what we're going to find is that open personalities now have access to things that no ancestor got anything close to. And so this is a problem. And so in order to not sound, you know, sanctimonious and like my Methodist, you know, minister grandfather, the truth is that you should be exquisitely careful with your brain. It's the only one you've got. And this is, I see equal and greater potential damage with pharmaceuticals, that the whole world is basically asleep at the switch and thinking that, gee, we're going to go in here and monkey with your neurochemistry.
Just going to target one neurotransmitter, no problem.
No problem.
As if we understand it.
Yeah, we have no understanding. And I have people, you know, my very open friends will often tell me that they went and used, I don't know, psilocybin or whatever it's called, out in the desert, and it helped their PTSD. And again, as Jen's warning, like, yeah, you think that's true, but how do you know what impact that's going to have? That didn't fix something in your information processing system. That damaged something in your brain. Okay? And so these are, in general, my attitude that you can feel through the pros of the pleasure trap. And it's not, you know, even though it's, I've got, you know, Alan Goldhammer, you know, nudging me along on a sanctimonious path there. But the truth is that he and I see things similarly, which is that, you know, the best bet is to live as healthy and naturally as is reasonable. And we get into any of these things, you know, knowing, as Jen says, if it's a little bit of influence, it's probably got a little bit of pushback, a la caffeine, pretty minor league. And if you can handle social drinking, that's going to be probably no big deal. But along the way here, keep your eyes peeled and be wary, because your mind wasn't meant to have any of these things. It's meant to breathe clean air, work hard, try to win esteem from the people in the village that matter, and never have access to anything psychoactive. That's actually how you were designed.
It's actually a really important point, because it's similar to supernormal food. There's another piece of this, which is that people, you play around with these things and you reset the expectations of the pleasure pathways to a different level. And so you're kind of depriving yourself of optimal joy, of natural pleasures, when you when you overstimulate these pathways, whether it's because you spent a life eating pizza and Snickers bars, and so now kale and sweet potatoes are just not that exciting to you, where you would never have known the difference. You could have gone through life like completely enjoying your kale and your sweet potatoes if you hadn't kind of set the bar at this higher level, where you always feel this slight pang of this loss to the potential pleasure in the system when you've hacked around with this kind of stuff. And that was part of the discussion that we were having about alcohol as well, where people who had that benefit, had that collective endorphin experience, the lowering of inhibitions, the ease of the social connections, all of these things, you know how easy that can be with the drug. And then when you take the drug away, it's always kind of this feeling of you're outside looking in, you're missing out on something, you're not able to reach that level of connection and to have those kinds of relationships that are completely natural to the species otherwise. But you've permanently distorted yourself and your estimation of what life should look like by using drugs that were never intended for human use. So there's a little bit of there's poignancy associated with that. So especially if you're open, especially if you have quote unquote an addictive personality, people will use that phrase not really knowing what it means. But it's if that's the sort of situation you find yourself in, you're diminishing your life experience overall.
Strangely.
Yeah.
It's a paradoxical diminishment.
It is.
Mm-hmm. And now with drugs, this can sometimes permanently alter the pleasure pathways. With food, though, luckily it doesn't always work that way.
Yeah, it's not going to work that way, but it still can create a remarkably slippery slope that's hard to get out of. So that's what the pleasure trap's about. It's that story.
Well, just another reason to go spend time with Nathan at the Fasting Escape if you need to reset your pleasure pathways.
It's very, very, absolutely very true. And this is a la the Dalai Lama who talked about every now and then,
go
out in the woods.
Go make yourself suffer a little bit and recalibrate as best as you can to scarcity.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, we talked about that a few weeks ago with the dopamine fasters, like if you go take a fast from dopamine so you're not so overstimulated all the time. So there's some truth in that.
All right. Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, we really appreciate it. It's a really fun discussion about the sadness and the cravings, and also the using chemicals to manage lives. And Dr. Hawk, thank you for sharing some of your story with us.
Sure. Anytime.
We will look forward to talking with you both next week. Thank you very much.
Very good, Nathan.
Sounds
Thank
good.
You.
Have a great night, Nathan. Bye.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.